supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The midterm election is expected to be a standout with high stakes in terms of which party will lead Senate and House in Washington. Locally in Pennsylvania, control of the state legislature means control over voter redistricting lines next year. In light of this, there's been an extremely heavy rotation of attack ads and dire political emails. Many are full of distortions and half-truths, and the negativity seems to be working to sway our thoughts and our voting power. American political satirist P.J. O'Rourke said this, "The American political system is like fast food, mushy, insipid, made out of disgusting parts or things, and everybody wants some." Well, on today's show, we're going to be talking about what influences our decisions and attitude about politics, the truth, our truth and trust in politics passé, and where do we go to get real information. We're joined by three guests, Art Kaplan, David Redlosk, and Eugene Kiley. Art Kaplan is here in the studio. He directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Art, welcome back to the
Thanks
show.
Thanks for having me.
David is a professor and director at the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers. He's the author of How Voters Decide, Information Processing in an Election Campaign. He joins us by phone. David, welcome.
Thanks, Dan.
And Eugene's here in the studio with us. He's the director of the Philadelphia office of factcheck.org. He's been a journalist for more than 20 years. And he's here in the studio. Welcome, Eugene. It's good to have all three of you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And we look forward to your phone calls. Our number is 888-477-9499. We want to know how you're affected by negative campaigning and where you get the information you want to get about your candidates running for office. Again, that's 888-477-9499. All right, let me start with you. Democracy is based on trust. So for some 225 years, we have elected representatives. We've sent them off to Washington, kind of trusting that they would represent our interest. And now we send them to Washington with very little trust and a bad taste in our mouths after voting. What are the implications?
Well, the implications are huge. Politically, if you look at the political philosophers who were the, much invoked these days, founding fathers of our government, they believe that there was a contract between the people and their elected representatives, that the elected representatives were not going to operate with the traditional authority of the monarchy or the traditional blessing of the gods in some divine right of king sense. They ran and operated with the trust of the people. I still think that is correct today, and I think what we're seeing in the current political climate is ideology being used to undermine trust. You basically have ideology first, no willingness to compromise or listen to the other side, and I think that engenders a kind of almost disgust with politics where a small number of people vote, and a smaller number of people are actually going to wind up electing our representatives.
David, let's turn to you. Do you think truth and trust are essentially eliminated from our political discourse?
Well, truth and trust are clearly important. And voters need to have some sense that the people they send to represent them can be trusted to do what they say they'll do. But we actually have a really long history of not being so certain that that's true. I mean, Americans have always been a bit dubious about their government and about the people who represent them, but it's really come to a head since the early 1970s, essentially since Watergate, when we saw a dramatic drop in trust in government, and that has just stayed down and continued to go down. The interesting thing, however, and a bit surprising perhaps, is during this decade, we've seen a consistent increase in voter turnout in both presidential and congressional elections. It's still below many other industrialized democracies, but since 2000, turnout's actually been up, even as trust has stayed at record low levels.
David, are politicians giving us what we want, or are we being told what we want?
You know, to some degree, politicians need to respond to what they think voters want. After all, a politician who ignores what voters want is likely to be out of office. But there's some question about whether voters really understand what they want or what they need all the time, and whether our politicians should, in fact, spend most of their time pandering, in a sense, what do you want, I'll give it to you, or should they perhaps lead occasionally because they've got more knowledge, more information, they kind of know what's going on. The challenge is that if you lead and you turn around to find people aren't following you, once again, you're potentially in trouble.
Art, I realized when I wrote this question that it was pretty cynical on my part, but that doesn't mean it's not accurate. I'll put it out there. It's becoming more clear to me that what most politicians want is power.
Mm-hmm.
Is they want their jobs. They'll do almost whatever they can to keep their jobs. How did we get here? I mean, I'll bring Eugene in too, because you've had 20 years of this. How did we get here? I mean, and now I'm very concerned about, you know, state elected offices where everything's going to be redistricted, and it's just going to increase the anger and the angry, shallow discourse. Gene?
Well, how did we get here? I don't know that where we are is any different than where we've been in historically in the past, and maybe Art, you can speak to that. But it may seem worse, but I'm not sure that it is worse by any historical standards.
I think we got to where we are in part because we're a very oddball political entity, very diverse, geographically sprawling. It's always been tough to get a sense of community purpose. It's always been tough to get a sense of Americanness out of the polity. When we have a war, that's useful. It helps pull us together. When we have a common enemy like the Russians, useful, pulls us together. But in general, we're a society that has been built on almost individualism and a certain degree of what I'll call Western expansion, rugged frontiersman kind of thinking. That gives us a politics that isn't very community-minded. And I think that's what your cynicism is about. It's sort of saying, where's the sense that, as in Canada, social solidarity, a value written into the Constitution, pursuit of individual happiness written into the American Constitution. Very different philosophical outlooks on what government is for.
Well, I would argue with you. I'm not a historian. I'm a shrink, but wasn't John Adams more concerned about the social fabric?
Some of the founders absolutely were, but I don't think that's been a value that's been easy to maintain in a, what I'll call, geographically sprawling, multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious society. You know, half of the benefits that you see put in as social protections in the United States are kind of hung out there as bribes. Join our union, back our movement, we'll give you something. It's not community-mindedness. It's not looking out for your neighbor. It's this will be to your advantage if you bother to associate with that guy you can't stand. That's what I'm talking about when I'm saying it's hard to pull us together.
Dave here, we should also be a little bit careful about holding up the past as some shining beacon. Generally, I mean, George Washington complained bitterly about his enemies and how they were trying to tear him down. And, you know, the people opposed in the Adams-Jefferson election in 1800, Adams supporters said there'd be blood on the streets and incest practiced openly if Thomas Jefferson was elected. So we actually have a long history of this kind of cynicism and negativity and attack stuff. But, of course, we have a media environment that's very different these days.
David, I got upset when you were talking about Adams, Jefferson, and some of the campaigning there, because I really want to hold on to my illusions. So, you know, I'd appreciate if you let me.
The founders really were human beings, weren't they? I mean, they had all the same passions and desires that I think modern politicians have as well, although I think they were also aware that they were doing something that was quite unheard of in the world to that time.
I'm curious, David, back to you. 2008, seems like most of the country was mobilized. There was an energy, and it was a positive energy. And now it seems almost the opposite. I mean, there is some energy, and I think it's on the Republican side, but it's not positive. It's not enthusiasm. What is all this dramatic change in two short years?
Well, it's the economy. I mean, it really is the economy. It's the economy in the sense that, of course, people are frustrated and they're not sure they're seeing any fruits of what they were promised in 2008. I also think that the Obama campaign, which brilliantly used the idea of hope and change, also set itself up in a sense. Mm. You know, you created expectations. The campaign absolutely created expectations. The energy was amazing. I was at the Democratic National Convention. I sat there in the Iowa delegation. You know, it was an unbelievable experience, and it was inevitable that you can't maintain it in governing. Governing is just completely different from campaigning. And those founders of ours designed a government that actually is meant not to work very easily.
Mm. Eugene?
Well, just to build on that, I think he's absolutely right about that. And one of the things that the problem with the economy is that we're not seeing any positive movement. I mean, the unemployment rate is at 9.6%. Republicans have been running ads, and the Republican groups have been running ads that the stimulus has failed, and healthcare is going to make it worse, and the deficit is ballooning, and all these things are resonating because of their own personal experiences that voters are having, that things are not getting better.
So both sides tend to pander to fear or raise fear when it's not there. We've been doing it all along. But in a recession or in a devastating economy, fear is there to begin with. I think even those who haven't been hit hard directly, our anxiety is still higher, our baseline anxiety. So it's easy to feed fear in that context. David, let's talk about polling. Should we put a lot of trust in polls?
You know, I get that question all the time, and the answer that I always give is that you should more or less ignore any one poll, but the big picture provides real guidance. And what I mean by that is that it isn't that there isn't, you know, that legitimately done polls that are done using appropriate methodologies are pretty accurate. I mean, there are margin of error, and that depends on the number of respondents and all those kinds of things. But the reality is that any one poll is a snapshot in time. And so when we look at that, we're not predicting the future, which is how we always talk about them. We're predicting the past. We're saying, you know, at the time of this poll, here's what people thought. The reason I suggest that you can look at groups of polls, large numbers of polls of the same thing, is that then you get the picture. You get a real sense of the pattern, and you'll find that some polls are way off. They're outliers. But polls tend to group, and they tend to give you a legitimate, valuable picture of where things stand.
Hmm. You know, I was going to say that there is a lot of science to polling, and I mean by that you can spin the poll, you can frame the poll in ways to get results that may favor a direction one way or the other, whether you as a pollster, want that or unintentionally do it. I was looking at some information recently on healthcare polls. If you ask Americans, do you like government-run healthcare? Nah, I don't like that. Do you like Medicare? Yes, I love that. And depending on which way you ask, you're going to get trends that indicate Americans, you know, are very nervous about the government, or, as we all know, that famous phrase, keep the, you know, I want the government to keep its hands off my Medicare. Medicare is the winner. Any question that puts Medicare into the poll triumphs. So,
yeah, exactly.
You have to be...
Eugene?
And that's what we're looking for when we're looking at these ads, is that the Republicans refer to the health care legislation as a government takeover of health care. They'll refer to the estate tax as being the death tax. You know, there are phrases and words that are tested in focus groups that work, and they use them, and we see them, and it contributes to what we're seeing right now.
Eugene, I want to know, you might disagree with my observation, but I want to know what the hell is going on this campaign season. I mean, candidates are, many of them are just bizarre. I mean, the ads are unbelievable, and it's going from ugly to almost comical with some of these. It really does feel different this election to me.
And I think it is different for a bunch of different reasons. One is, as you mentioned, the fear factor that's already built into this election because of the economy, and that's being exploited well. There's also the fact that there's more advertising than there's ever been before. So far, that's been spent over $3 billion, and it should be or could be going up to $4 billion, which would not only be more than what we saw in the last midterm election, but more even in the last presidential election in 2008, which is unusual for a midterm. And the groups that are spending the monies are not just the candidates. There are a lot of outside money that's being poured into this race that goes back to a Supreme Court decision that was issued in January, the Citizens United case, that allowed for corporations and labor unions to spend more money in this race with less restrictions.
You know, it's very funny, Dan. In my line of work in medicine, we have had over the past couple of years a movement so that every doctor has to disclose gifts of $10 or more. We know who's trying to influence them from industry. And yet in the political side, we have this court decision, the Supreme Court, saying, no, you don't have to make transparent who your funding sources are. It's clear from the point of view of ethics, if you want accountability and trust, you have to have transparency, and we have not had that in this election.
Right.
Well, just to fact check you there for a second, the Supreme Court actually said that there should be disclosure. The problem is that with the amount of the way that the laws were written with IRS, you can create these nonprofits don't have to disclose for good reasons their donors. But the problem is when they become active politically, then should something be done?
So I want to come back to the campaign and the distortions, your expertise. You brought a campaign ad that you brought with us or shared with us. It's a pretty ugly campaign out of Florida. Let's listen.
I'm Congressman Alan Grayson, and I approve this message.
Religious fanatics try to take away our freedom in Afghanistan, in Iran, and right here in Central Florida.
Wives, submit yourself to your own husband.
Daniel Webster wants to impose his radical fundamentalism on us.
She should submit to me. That's in the Bible.
Webster tried to deny battered women medical care and the right to divorce their abusers.
Submit to me.
He wants to force raped women to bear the child.
Submit to me.
Taliban Dan Webster. Hands off our bodies and our laws.
Taliban Dan Webster. So, fact check. So where did this come from? She should submit to me.
Well, this was a very interesting ad, and it's an example of the kind of attack ads that are least effective, I think. What Grayson's campaign did was take some creative liberties in the use of a video that showed Dan Webster speaking to a group of It was at a religious event where he was speaking to a group of men about the Bible and families and family life and all that. And what he said was completely different than the way that it was used by the campaign. What he said was that they used the word, "She should submit to me, that's in the Bible." Well, that's not what he said. He said, when you pick a verse in the Bible, don't pick the ones that said, "She should submit to me." That's in the Bible, but pick the ones you're supposed to do. Huh. So it was a matter of creative editing. And the interesting thing is that the campaign came back with a follow-up ad that did it right. And we said that they did it right, because there's the information in the ad had some basic elements of truth to it, but the total distortion of the video clip was outrageous.
What do you mean they did it right? What was right?
Well, there are some facts in there that are true. And the wording of it was over the top in the first ad. In the second ad, they came back and they worded it in a way that made it factually correct.
David, I want to turn to you before our break, and I want to get into voters' attitudes, because in previewing this ad that Eugene brought for us, in previewing it, I wanted to turn it off in the middle. I hated every minute of it. And do these people really believe that their opponent is as awful as they say they are? And if they don't, how do they live with themselves?
That's a good question. I actually think that for the most part, candidates don't necessarily feel quite the way about their opponent that they appear to. And what I mean by that is that anybody running for office has to believe he or she is the best choice. You cannot put yourself out there any other way. And beyond that, if you don't win, you lose. It's a zero-sum game in this system. So if you believe you are the best, and if you know that if you don't win, you lose, it's a very easy and slippery slope to doing things that you just normally would not do. Then throw in the consultants who actually design the ads, who actually put them together and put them out there, who really, you know, they're doing it for pay. I mean, they may have a preference, but, you know, this is a job. And you get this kind of thing. And let me say, though, that voters recognize this kind of ad for what it is. It is mudslinging. It is not truth-based, and I happen to believe voters are pretty good at identifying the junk. And if we see what's happened in that particular race, that ad was a clear turning point for Grayson, just pushing him to where he just has no chance whatsoever.
That's interesting. Well, we've got to take a break now. We're talking about political dialogue or political monologue, maybe, and what's accurate, what's not. Why and how it affects us, how we are being influenced or not. My guests are Art Kaplan, Eugene Kiley, and David Redlosk. Art directs the Center for Bioethics here at the University of Pennsylvania. David's a professor and director at the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers. And Eugene is the director of the Philadelphia Office of FactCheck.org. Our number is 888-477-9499. I promise I won't hog these guys for the whole session. I'll share them with you. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We'll be back in just 1 minute. We're here on WHYY-FM.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Neurological Institute, with the one traumatic brain injury and concussion program in South Jersey. Whether injured on or off the job, Cooper doctors take a multidisciplinary team approach to head injuries, with neurosurgeons, neuropsychologists, and specialists in physical medicine and pediatrics working together to create a plan of care. For information on how Cooper is advancing medicine in South Jersey, cooperhealth.org/numbers or 800-8-COOPER.
Coming of Age presents Boomer Vision, how siblings can deal with their aging parents and each other, with author Francine Russo, Wednesday, November 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Dorrance H. Hamilton Public Media Commons at WHYY. Learn better ways to communicate and win support when siblings are in different places, geographically, emotionally, or both. Boomer Vision. To reserve your spot, 215-351-0511 or whyy.org/wider horizons.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Politics, how are you feeling about them this year, and why? We're talking about the political dialogue, what happens, why it is the way it is this year especially, and what impact it's having on us. My guests are David Redzlock, Gene Kiley, and Art Kaplan. David's professor and director at the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers. He joins us by phone. Eugene is director of the Philadelphia office of factcheck.org, and Art directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Art, in this election, people talk a lot about complacency, but as I listen to these ads and what I'm experiencing this campaign season is futility. More than complacency.
I think that's right. I think a lot of people, as was pointed out earlier, put down some chits on hope, and hope got dashed. We have a lousy economy. Probably the keystone program that the Congress and the president pushed through, health care reform, is something that everybody seems to be running away from. So it's not being brought forward as a triumph. It's being brought forward as something that is clearly an error, and that if that isn't the definition of futility, I don't know what is. No one's defending the program. No one's defending the big reform. And it seems to me, too, that people feel there is a kind of disconnect between the powers that run Washington and what they can accomplish in their individual districts in terms of voting and changing direction. I don't think that people think they can causally affect change.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Ted on the line. Hey, Ted, you're on Voices. Ted, do we have you?
Hi, guys. Thanks for the conversation.
Sure.
Just while I'm listening to you, I'm thinking the term fact check seems almost forgiving of what seems to be a lot of lies out there. Maybe it should be called lie check. But my question is, and having kids, I'm always talking to them about telling lies and the consequences of it. You know, how much are all these lies going to kind of relate to us, like the little boy that cried wolf, when we figure out that, you know, we're just used to them lying, so now we're not even going to believe anything they say, even when they're telling the truth. And it seems to be that, you know, they're throwing more and more ads at us, trying to convince us of something we're becoming less and less convinced of.
Interesting. Let me turn to David.
Yeah, you know, it is really, really difficult to disentangle the question of why people have become negative towards government generally. And clearly some sense that people are lying to us is part of it. But it's not, you know, the election campaign season, while it seems a little overwhelming, is only part of the year, right? I mean, there's a lot more going on most of the year. And to some degree, I wonder if it isn't as much a combination of what we see on our television with the ads, but maybe even more so what we're seeing on our television with the pundits. And the you know, I hate to kind of simply parrot Jon Stewart from the weekend, but, you know, what we're getting is people screaming at each other from both sides. And I think the public as a whole, whether it's candidates or whether it's pundits, people begin to be very turned off by the whole thing. But having said that, and as a political scientist, I always throw in the other hands constantly. As I said earlier, turnout is actually up over this decade. And that suggests, in fact, that people have become more mobilized, even in spite of feeling more frustrated, or maybe because they're feeling more frustrated.
Mm. Let's shift gears here, and I'm going to turn back to you, Eugene. I'm going to play a sample of a positive campaign ad here. We had to go back quite a bit to find one. So we went back to the 90s, And this is from Hillsborough, New Jersey, a race, and a group of politicians from the same party are running in bulk, so to speak. So let's listen to this.
We have a lot to protect in Hillsborough. Our open space, our small town values, a corner of New Jersey unlike any other. Four Democrats for Township Committee are determined to preserve Hillsborough just the way it is. Christine Jensen, John Gilardi, Sonia Ann Martin, and Bob Mack. They're fighting the Greenbrier development and its 3,000 new houses, and they'll preserve our open space without raising taxes. The Hillsborough Democrats, to preserve Hillsborough.
Fact check on that.
Fact check on that?
Well, I know you can't do it specifically, but, you know, are promises lies? I mean, we heard, who did we hear that from? George Bush the First? No new taxes? Was that Bush one?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Read my lips.
It was.
Yeah.
Read my lips.
Yeah.
Well, there are certainly falsehoods that could be put into positive ads, as you might call them. But those kinds of ads, the ads that advocate for or promote a candidate, those ads have declined substantially.
Yeah.
And there was a story in this morning's New York Times on the Wesleyan Media Project, which is run at a Wesleyan University in Connecticut, that showed that just since 2002, that 50% of the ads in 2002 were these that advocate for or promote a candidate, like the one we just heard. That number is down to a quarter. And the attack ads have flipped. So they've jumped from a quarter to more than a half.
On these ads, if I can jump in real quick, the challenge on these ads, positive ads, interestingly enough, carry actually less informative content than negative ads. Research studies have shown that, you know, positive ads are generally puffery, you know, much like any product, about how good it is. And negative ads, on the other hand, are usually sourced in the sense that, you know, and fact check is right, a lot of them are distorted, but in fact there's usually some source right in the ad saying, you know, this came from XYZ newspaper on whatever date. And in a sense, the irony here is it's the negative ads that are potentially more informative to voters.
And of course, much more difficult to find what's true and what's real in here. David, I know you've got to go in just a couple of minutes, but I want to follow up something you said before the break. And that is, people who run for office have to believe that they're the best, that they're the best running. And I've always wondered this. Is there a quality of narcissism or grandiosity that's almost a job requirement here?
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I have run for office. I have lost and I have won in local elections.
Are you a narcissist?
I've sat on a town council, and I will tell you that even at the most local level, there is something about sitting there. Yes, you better believe in yourself, and once you're there, you know, you've got to have some sense of narcissism. I think you have to have some sense of self. I think most people go into this for good reasons. That is, they intend to do good by us. They intend to be positive forces. I'm not sure that things don't pull them in other directions once they're there. It's a very difficult environment. But yeah, I think to get back to it, anyone who doesn't have some sense of ego shouldn't be in this business. On the other hand, some people have so much of a sense of ego, they shouldn't be in this business either.
Yeah, you're not kidding. And I would imagine that too much of a sense of ego thing runs rampant. Can I ask you to stick with us just one
or
two more minutes? Because
sure.
We've got another caller that you might be interested in. Marianne.
Hi, Dr. Dan.
Hi, Marianne. You're on the air. What can we do for you?
Well, I'd actually like to know if your guests could speak to the fear factor. I'd like to know why politicians use negative reinforcement so much when, as you know and I've learned, positive reinforcement works longer term. And in this political cycle, they've done nothing to assuage fears. It's more like they incite fears. And I've gone to several of the debates, and last year I went to all the town halls in my area, and it's just despicable. Last year they're sitting there holding up the health care bill, all, you know, 2,500 pages of it, and people are screaming, stay out of my Medicare, and not once did my representative point out that Medicare is a government program.
I want to turn to David with that, because Marianne raises a good point. I mean, we know that positive reinforcement is what changes behavior.
Right, and the problem is, however, that we are also wired as human beings to pay attention to the negative. That
yeah.
is, if we're in a if we're in an environment, and if you think kind of about this, it makes sense. If we're in an environment, the things we need to pay attention to are the things that might hurt us. And in some sense, therefore, we you know, some of the theorizing about emotions suggests that we have a surveillance system, a system that's generated by a sense of anxiety, that when we become anxious, we begin to pay more attention, we begin to do more research, we begin to look into more about what's causing this anxiety. Consultants understand this. Political consultants understand this. They understand that anxious voters are more likely to actually pay some attention. They're more likely to hear the message. And so even though we react viscerally and we say we don't like it when we're asked, the evidence actually is that there is something to this when you're trying to break through all the noise.
Hmm. Art.
I was going to say, I agree with that to a point, but we also know that there's the phenomenon of learned helplessness. You can scare somebody again and again and again and again, but at some point, you give up. And I know that I myself, I'll just speak for myself, I'm a political junkie, I'm interested in politics. If someone tries to scare me every 30 seconds over the last 3 weeks, I withdraw.
Well, I want to support what David's saying here. We did a show right before the Bush re-election, so what was that, 2004, and he studied anxiety and behavior in general, not just voter. And what this group found is the more our anxiety goes up, the more we tend to clutch on our beliefs. Mm-hmm. And as anxiety goes up even higher, our beliefs get more primitive. So black and white, good and bad, evil and pious. And, I mean, that was what was going on in 2004, and that's kind of what's going on here. As anxiety goes up, we clutch more tightly to our beliefs, and we don't listen.
Mm.
You know, listening stops when we're clutching.
Yeah, that was my point. I think we stopped
high
listening.
High levels, absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And then that's the challenge. It's low levels of anxiety generate a sense that we're going to pay some attention and try to figure out what's going on. High levels and in a sense, particularly fear, can simply shut things down. But at a certain level, that's sometimes what the candidate wants. That is, they don't want you to think. They want you to stay with them.
Well, David, listen, you said you had to go. We've kept you for an extra 5 minutes. We'll pay you the overtime.
Well, this has been great fun. I'm sorry I have to leave it.
Yeah, me too. Thanks so much for joining us. That was David Redlosk. He's a professor and director at the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers, and he's the author of How Voters Decide, Information Processing in an Election Campaign. Well, we've got a couple of lines open at 1-888-477-9499 if you'd like to join this discussion about advertising, politicians, how and why we decide. More important, I'd like to hear what impact this campaign season has had on you as a voter. 888-477-9499. Art Kaplan and Eugene Kiley will be staying with us. Art directs the Center for Bioethics at U of P, and Eugene's the director of the Philadelphia office of factcheck.org. He's been a political journalist for 20 years, and we're going to talk about that, Eugene. I want to hear about your perspective. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY and opens its 32nd season with A.R. Gurney's Sylvia, now through November 7th. Sylvia is the hilarious story of Greg, who brings home a dog he's found in the park and the adjustments that he's forced to make to his life and marriage. This play examines the complicated relationships between husbands and wives and the pets that love them. Directed by David Stradley, starring Maggie Lacus as Sylvia, 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org.
On the next Fresh Air...
I've been over this 100 times about my anger at my father for walking out and my mother's suicide when I was 17. My need to save people as a result.
Gabriel Byrne is back for a third season of HBO's In Treatment with new patients and a new therapist. We talk with writers Dan Futterman and Anya Epstein. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Politics, how do you feel about them? How do you feel about them this campaign season versus other campaign seasons? And why? We're talking with Art Kaplan, who directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and Eugene Kiley. He's the director of the Philadelphia office of factcheck.org. Eugene, I want to start with you. I've learned there's a lot of ways information and quotes can be distorted and taken out of context. We heard one little bit earlier in the show. Another way is by grossly omitting facts. One example is the Democrats are running misleading ads in several House and Senate races, accusing the Republicans of supporting a 23% national sales tax. Now, what they leave out is that while candidates might support a national sales tax, they would only do so if it replaces all federal and income payroll taxes. Here's an ad, this from the Arizona House race between Democrat Gabrielle Gifford and Republican Jesse Kelly. Let's listen.
We're really struggling at this point to make ends meet. We could never afford to pay 23% more on groceries or gas. Jesse Kelly's sales tax is going to hurt my family and other families in the middle class. People like Jesse Kelly are going to be supporting corporations over people. He's not looking out for me. He's not looking out for my family. We could not afford Jesse Kelly's tax. We absolutely couldn't.
I'm Gabrielle Giffords, and I approve this message.
You know, it's interesting, Eugene. I'm going to turn to you. This business of, and I approve this message, used to mean something when they first started doing it. You know, you couldn't go too far afield or else, you know, the candidate themselves would feel besmirched. But I guess besmirched is, well, whatever. So what about this ad?
Well, this line of attack is has emerged as a major Democratic theme. As Dan said before, the Republicans are running away from health care, stimulus, all the things that they did. So instead, what they're latching onto are issues like this, which may or may not resonate with the public and doesn't seem to so far. And what we've seen, did a count of the TV ads, and there's been at least 33 spots since August, as of October 20th, on this theme of the fair tax is going to, and they don't say that it's going to just raise your taxes 23%. They'll pick on things that are important to us. You know, they're going to raise tax on food, clothes, medical care, stuff like that.
And they can get away with just lying like that.
Well, I don't want to call it lying, but they can get away with it because it's political speech that's protected by the First Amendment. There are some states that try to regulate this in some form. Ohio, for example, will allow you to file a complaint, and they'll review the complaint, and they'll come back, and they'll slap you on the wrist. They'll give you a reprimand. There are no penalties other than that.
Ouch. Let's go back to the phones. We got a lot of people wanting to join the conversation. Lisa, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering if you could let us know about some good sources where we can find information about the election that kind of streamline facts. The issues are sort of set forth, and I know it's true, the information on it, because I get a little overwhelmed with the ads and the information coming at me, and I really don't believe a lot of what I hear.
Oh, bless your heart, Lisa. I wish everybody in who votes would have your questions. So, Eugene, of course, factcheck.org.
Yes, I would highly recommend factcheck.org as one site to start.
He's spinning.
Well, and the reason for that is because, as we just heard with this ad that you played, a lot of the same themes are cropping up in race after race after race. Here in Pennsylvania, one that I've been seeing in the district that I live in, which is Pat Murphy's district, where they've been the Republican candidate, Mike Fitzpatrick, a former congressman, has been criticizing Pat Murphy for voting to send jobs to China. Well, that's a theme that we've seen repeatedly, and I just wrote about it recently. I didn't mention Mike Fitzpatrick or Patrick Murphy because there were so many other candidates to mention. But if you're looking for information about whether the content of the ads are correct or not, try us.
Well, let me speak on Lisa's behalf because, in a way, I've got a lot in common with Lisa. So we can go to factcheck.org to check facts of something we are hearing on the air. But is there anywhere I can go and Lisa can go to find out what the real story is with candidate X versus candidate Y? You know, you can't go to their webpage because that's just more advertising. Is there any resource for us?
Well, there are a lot of resources. Of course, there's a lot of information that's available on the internet, and I would trust the information that that we know is trustworthy. And maybe some others don't think the Philadelphia Inquirer is a trustworthy paper. I worked there for 7 years. I think it's a great newspaper, and they have political site, political information available. There are organizations like the League of Women Voters who tabulate information and provide it on their website and available for newspapers to run that contrast the candidates. There's a lot of information out there. You have to be take it with a grain of salt. Depending on the site you go, you have to know the source that you're going to.
That's I think that's great advice and that's great resources for you, Lisa. Thanks so much for calling. You know, Art, when I look at this discourse, of course, I look at it through the eyes of a therapist. And when I work with couples and trust is broken, well, trust is the bedrock of a relationship. And once it's lost, it's hard to reclaim. And it gets reclaimed. Trust gets reestablished and the relationship can improve. But both parties really want to reestablish trust. And I'm not hearing anybody who wants to reestablish trust. Nobody. Maybe it's too much of a generalization, but I haven't heard anybody.
You know, in the two previous presidential campaigns, George W. Bush promised that were he to be elected, he would reach out and cross party lines. And so did Barack Obama, both of them promising to repair, if you will, loss of trust after the election, work with the other guys. I think what's happened in the current election is the Republicans see the Democrats as going further to the left. The Republicans have gone further to the right. Reaching out to bridge that, to rebuild trust after this particular campaign, strikes me as, I'll put it in therapeutic terms, a long process. I mean, it's going to be tough to bridge back after this very heated, ideological, fear-driven campaign. So I think you're right. To have, in a sense, common purpose and get to common goals, you have to have trust. Truth-telling is, most philosophers would argue, a key element of creating trust. But if you have a heated campaign that goes to spin and fear, I'm skeptical about how quickly you're going to be able to have anybody reaching across the
aisle. Yeah, you know, Art, I'm listening to you describe the larger context of what happened with both sides and the increased pull to extremes on both sides. And I'm thinking Middle East peace talks. Mm. I mean, it's just got that same
feel
and I'm afraid the same prognosis. Eugene, tell us about what you do at Fact Check.
Well, what we do at Fact Check are go through ads in mostly in the national or high-profile races, high-profile Senate races like in Nevada with Harry Reid, or out in California, or the governor's races as well. And we're looking for ads that are deceiving the voters. We're also looking for trend pieces, kind of theme pieces, where we're seeing a lot, as we just showed before, on the fair tax, where the Democrats are misusing that. The Democrats also have been running a lot of ads about Social Security, talking about how the Republicans are going to privatize it, which isn't exactly what the Republicans are talking about. So there's what we're looking for are the most outrageous, which is what we saw with the Alan Grayson ad, where he totally distorted through some creative video editing what his opponent said. We're looking for big major theme pieces in themes of the election, and we're also looking to track the most important and most interesting races that would have the most national interest.
So I've got to ask you an unfair question. We've got about 30 seconds left. You've been in the field for 20 years. Summarize the change you've seen over 20 years.
Well, it's interesting because I started in Washington back in 1990, and I went back in 2007 at the USA Today. And the biggest difference is they begin campaigning immediately. There's no pause for governing. Both sides will start digging in and trying to already force the other candidates and force their opponents to be casting votes that they can be using in these attack ads that we're seeing now. And that, I think, is the biggest change.
Yeah, and that would also explain why governing is being done so poorly and certainly the opposite of seamlessly.
And it's Republicans and Democrats,
as we saw
with George Bush and now Barack Obama.
Yeah, interesting. Well, unfortunately, we've got to close. I apologize to all the people on the phone lines who we didn't have time to bring in. And I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
We
heard from Art Kaplan, who directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. We heard earlier from David Redlosk. He's a professor and director at the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers. And Eugene Kiley is director of the Philadelphia office of factcheck.org. He's been doing this for 20 years. Next week on Voices in the Family, the story of fostering foster care kids, the special love and guidance it takes to set them up for success in young adults. Hey, listen, do you think happiness is necessary? Do you think it's important? Well, this Thursday, November 4th, I'll be giving a lecture with that same title. Come out and get the answers. I'd love to see you there. I'm at the Transformation Holistic Learning Center in Voorhees, New Jersey. Go to readytotransform.com, or it's on my webpage too, drdangottlieb.com. Well, if you want to reach us, we're whyy.org. We'd love to hear from you with ideas, show ideas, comments about past shows. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Thanks, Kevin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. Maggie Zahn and Stephanie Pena are our interns. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Tell me.